Thanks for tuning in and welcome to the January 7th, 2019 edition of IMRU Radio Magazine.
The nation's longest running lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender radio show.
Out front and out loud since 1974.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Abby Dees.
Tonight we focus on personal stories.
Which is always our mandate, but we are recommitting to this with special vigor in 2019.
We'll hear tales from Hole drummer Patty Schemmel, singer Sam Harris, baseballer Billy Bean, humorist David Sedaris, and we'll look back at a few of the poets from former WeHo Poet Laureate Stephen Raine's inaugural My Life is Poetry class in 2011.
Plus, we'll revisit one of our all-time favorite features, young Ben and Jessica Pensner, who shared their moving story on KPFK's Gay Day 2009.
But first, let's spill some tea.
The honest tea.
Oh, the first tea of the new year. Start.
I know. There were so many things that happened since we last talked,
Wenzel. What a busy holiday it's been.
But we had to just select a few to talk about, and so we're not going to talk about Kevin Hart.
No, we're not.
And we're not going to talk about the new president of Brazil making Brazil great again by erasing LGBT people, though we could.
We will be talking about him soon,
I'm sure we will. But, you know, we keep talking about him, so let's talk about something else. Oh, we keep talking about this one, too.
I know.
All right, so we have talked about the progress of the Trump's military trans ban through the various courts. So last we talked, there were four such cases moving their ways through the federal courts.
And it seemed like there was light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah,
but
and all the courts, including the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that we are part of, had basically said, no, you really can't do this. This is a discriminatory ban. Go away, neener, neener, stop it. But
yeah, because you can't make a blanket ban on people,
you
on a class
do
of
that.
People. And
however,
that seemed clear.
That seemed really obvious. However, one of those cases in the District of Columbia, that went up to the Court of Appeals. And on Friday, they actually overturned the lower court's ruling that blocked the ban. And they issued an order removing the temporary injunction or the preliminary injunction, which doesn't really have an effect because all those other courts have an injunction in place. But still, it's a I'm just going to say it. I read the opinion. It's stupid.
Okay, see, now this is where I need to be taken by the hand and led through it, because from what I read, it sounds as if they're saying it is not a blanket ban because we will allow transsexual personnel who do not live openly as transsexual personnel.
Transgender.
to be in the military. And that sounds just like a reboot of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and that didn't go well at all.
Yeah. So what happened was the first ban came through, and then all these people started filing suit, and so they went back. And the first ban, just to remind everybody, was a ban via Twitter. This was not something that had been run through the State Department or the Defense Department.
We forget so much because there's so much to absorb.
So then they sort of went back to the drawing board and they changed it. And so they changed the ban so that, and this was when Defense Secretary James Mattis was involved, so that it didn't apply if you were not diagnosed with gender dysphoria and if you agreed to serve in your birth gender. Now, just try to get your head around that.
Which would make you sort of not transgender, just...
Right. So, okay.
In a pickle, as it were.
So that was the, you know, trans ban Mark II. The court said on Friday that because that did allow some trans people to serve, it was not a blanket ban, and therefore the lower court erred in calling it a blanket ban. That was it.
And some sounds like very, very few at best.
Yeah. And I mean, just imagine this, if you just use this kind of thinking to something that dramatically, disproportionately affected, say, people of color or women.
Yeah.
You couldn't say that with a straight face that, well, you know, it doesn't hit them all, so therefore it's not a complete ban when it's actually targeting this group of people. It's such a bad analysis. I'm sorry, but it really doesn't pass the sniff test at all.
So what do you think is going to happen now? Will this collapse or?
Okay, so... The Defense Department, excuse me, not the Defense Department, the Trump administration, because I think the Defense Department has actually been, is in this clown car of a government that we have right now, actually probably the most reasonable people in handling this. The Trump administration has been pushing the Supreme Court to actually do a fast track review of all of these lower court cases. In other words, pushing to have them skip the whole appellate process. And so there's going to be a hearing on that, a private hearing on January 11th. So hopefully we will find out what happens to that. But the deal is this thing is going to end up one way or another in front of the Supreme Court. They don't have to take it, but they probably will. Anyway, it was just the ruling. I tried to make some sense of it and give them some benefit of a doubt, and I could not. It was a stupid ruling. That is my verdict on the situation.
And you're the one who went to law school, so you know.
Yes, I know everything.
I know.
About this stuff.
Well, it's an evergreen topic. I mean, we could talk about that every week.
Well, I could. And so recognizing that that might just be me, we have other stories.
Oh, good. Sunshiny ones,
sunshiny
I hope.
Ones. Also, I'm trying to get away from the all negative.
Okay.
You know, the
it's
sky's
a new
falling.
Year.
So, speaking of trans things, Democratic Congresswoman Jennifer Weston, who is a new member of Congress from Virginia, put a flag outside of her office door this week. This was her first act. And what kind of flag was it?
It was what's the official name? The trans
trans flag, or trans flag. Or okay. Trans pride flag.
It's the blue and pink one.
Yep. And she herself, as far as I know, is not trans, but she is the aunt of a trans
right.
kid. And she told a local newspaper, quote, "The trans community has been under attack, and I wanted to show my solidarity because we are talking about my friends and family." And to that, I just want to say, there you go, allies in action. That's how it works.
And I Googled it to see if anybody else had put up any flags, and I couldn't find anything. But I like the example she's setting, and I hope others follow suit.
I just think that's wonderful. And it really is sort of marking all the interesting things that are happening
right.
with 116th Congress that has more women than ever, the first Muslim women serving in Congress, the first Native American women, the youngest member of Congress.
I am loving this new Congress.
I'm loving it. And they're badass. And
I know.
You really want like congressional fun,
yeah.
Google the moment that Arizona set a senator who is openly bisexual, Kyrsten Sinema, got sworn in by Mike Pence.
It was great.
That was a lovely thing to watch.
I mean, from the outfit all the way
and
to
the
event.
And her swearing on the Constitution of Arizona and the U.S. and not on a Bible.
Right. Although I was wondering, because she made such a point about swearing with her hand on a law book, why did they end it with, "So help me God"? Why don't they throw that out or amend it?
I don't know.
I mean, she didn't stop the proceedings and make an issue out of it, but you think she's making a real point to do this in a non-religious specific way. Why do we end with "So help me God"?
I guess personal choice.
Okay.
I don't know. I could see myself doing that too.
All right.
I don't know.
Moving on.
Another story for another time.
Fun times. Speaking of fun stories, what's our favorite part of every day? Story time.
Story time.
And who best to tell a story? A drag queen?
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, there was an article in last week's paper sometime about Drag Queen Story Hour in the Eagle Rock Public Library.
Yes. So we only have one Drag Queen Story Hour in Los Angeles County, which I can't believe. 72
I couldn't
libraries.
Believe it either. Because the first time I ever encountered it was at DragCon.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my gosh, what a great idea. But I thought it was very site-specific, and then it turned out, no, Drag Queen Story Hour
is a thing.
It is kind of a thing all over the place, and then when this story came out about the Eagle Rock Library, I thought there's only one in the county.
Yep, and the drag queen in question is Pickle. Her name is Pickle.
And we can't wait to meet Pickle.
And we really,
I know,
okay,
we
Pickle,
really
if you're listening,
show.
Please get in touch with us. We want to talk to you. We want to come and listen to you tell a story.
And you have to wear that pink dress.
And I loved in one of the local papers, Spectrum News, a parent of a child said, "I want my daughter to love her brown skin, to love her curly hair, and accept people who are different from her." So she is a fan of Pickles at the Eagle Rock.
And surprisingly, I've got a friend who works at the public library in Douglas, Alaska, which is outside of Juneau, and they've had a Drag Queen Story Hour a couple times already, and Juneau had it once, and Anchorage had one where some parent took umbrage.
Yeah, well, they're taking umbrage all over the place right now in Tennessee, in Nashville. I just found out yesterday a bunch of pastors are all upset. But you know where else they're having Drag Queen Story Hour is in Houston, Texas, where a federal judge, see, I have to bring this back to law stuff, threw out a case against Drag Queen Story Hour. And so this guy named Christopher Sevier,
well, he's kind of sketchy anyway,
though. He's a sketchy guy. He brought the most novel argument, saying that Drag Queen Story Hour violates the First Amendment's prohibition on the establishment of religion. Why? Because Drag Queen Story Hour seeks to establish a religion of secular humanism. Okay, think about that.
Yeah, that hurts.
So the judge basically said, you know, in Texas, even the judges, you know, still, I hope, are holding on to basic concepts of the Constitution. They said they threw it out for failure to state a viable First Amendment Establishment Clause claim. Well, duh.
And I was watching a clip of a woman who's from L.A., but she went all the way out to a bookstore in Riverside because they were actually having, I believe, three drag queens reading books around Halloween. And she went all that way to protest. And
I just love what like, gets people out of the house.
I know, but it's like you don't have a child in the room. You don't have to be here. The people who are here are children, so their parents are clearly okay with it. What is why is being angry so enjoyable?
I don't know. And I am and I think there's some confusion too, because one of the Tennessee pastors that's all very upset about the Nashville Drag Queen Story Hour, and as you know, I love Nashville, so mm-hmm. I am going to go to Drag Queen Story Hour next time I'm there. But one of the Tennessee pastors said, "We don't believe in all this gender dysphoria mess." So obviously they're a little bit confused about Drag Queen Story Hour.
Well, if they don't believe it, it doesn't exist. That settles it.
Okay, but Eagle Rock Library.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to go see Pickle, and Pickle, come talk to us. And
I actually have a friend with a young daughter in Silver Lake, of course, and she was so pleased when it turned out her daughter found the Santa at the mall, a little upsetting.
Oh.
But she loves Drag Queen Story Hour.
There you go, priorities. I like her. So if you want to find out more about Drag Queen Story Hour, or start one at your local library, or just see what's going on, it's as simple as going to dragqueenstoryhour.org. There's actually a nonprofit that is organizing this stuff.
Why don't we make a date to go to a Drag Queen Story Hour?
We're going
to
go see Pickle.
Maybe to Pickles. Do we know them when the next one is?
I don't know. Okay. Got to find out.
All right. Well, that's the end of Drag Queen Story Hour, and we hope to see you all there. And now, former Hole drummer Patty Schemmel shares a story from her memoir, Hit So Hard.
One of the girls. Adolescence. Oh, God. Red hair and glasses. That was me in a nutshell, the dark side of a John Hughes movie. Also, gay. A burgeoning lesbian, which seemed like the most embarrassing, obvious thing. When I'd experience a flare-up, such as the time I'd made a pass at my best friend, drunkenly trying to kiss her, stupidly, insanely, that's when I'd blame it on being drunk. Alcohol gave me the bravery I needed to obliterate my self-esteem. I came out to my mother, who was supportive but unable to make me feel any better. The only thing that did at 14, 15, and 16 was this intense sense of connection I felt listening to punk music. I discovered a weird Canadian radio station, which first introduced me to The Fall, Wire, and the Butthole Surfers, the bands that would ultimately open me up to the possibility of a career spent repeatedly hitting things with sticks until they break. Punk had a violence that appealed to me. Instead of dancing or jumping up and down, going to shows was an excuse to crash into people or experience the delicious thrill of an accidental black eye. In the pit, everyone was equal. Girls were no different. There just weren't very many of them. When it came to my blossoming sexuality, so to speak, there weren't enough girls to choose from, so I'd have to make do with boys. I would have preferred not to be different in this regard. I wanted to spend 7 minutes in heaven with a guy. My chance came at my friend Debbie's birthday party in eighth grade. Debbie was hanging out with a kid named Bobby, and Bobby had a friend named Pat, who seemed nice enough and wore the same wire-rimmed glasses as I. Pat and Patty. It was perfectly obvious. As Billy Joel's new wave record Glass Houses played, the four of us danced awkwardly while attempting to make out without using our tongues. I was not excited about or interested in any of it. I just wanted to be doing whatever everybody else was.
Now, much younger person, is Patty Schemmel punk? Or to me, she's punk, but I don't know anything.
Here's what I think.
Okay.
Patty Schemmel and Hole are post-punk, because to me, punk ended in 1980.
And I'm sure there's a reason you say that.
And there are a lot of people who disagree with me.
Okay. So. Well, whatever. Anytime I hear people who come from that world and they're quiet, I'm always so impressed. Because I never think that they have quiet lives of introspection.
It's all about contrast.
Clearly they do.
Yeah. Well, Patty is married and runs a dog walking service in Silver Lake and has started performing again.
Yay. So with sardonic wit and incisive social critiques, David Sedaris has become one of America's preeminent humor writers. The author of 8 books and a regular contributor to This American Life on NPR, of course, he stopped by IMRU to share a few stories. And here's the clean one that we can air.
When I was growing up, my dad got this dream that all of his children would play a different musical instrument, and he wanted us to form a jazz combo. So my older sister took the piano, and another sister took the flute, and I was assigned the guitar, and I took guitar lessons from a midget, which really, you don't see midgets. And I'm not talking about a dwarf. He was an actual midget, and I was 12 years old, and I was just fascinated, thinking, you know, if it came down to it, this guy could hide just about anywhere. I didn't practice a guitar. I had other plans in mind, and so this is the last lesson when I went in. The following evening, I showed up for my lesson, and this time, when asked if I'd practiced, I told the truth, saying in a matter-of-fact tone of voice that no, I hadn't touched the thing since the last lesson. I told him that I had absolutely no interest in mastering the guitar. What I really wanted was to sing in the voice of Billie Holiday. Mainly commercials, but not for any banks or car dealerships, because those are usually choral arrangements. The color ebbed from my teacher's face. I told him I'd been working up a little act and could use some accompaniment. Did he know the jingle for the new Sara Lee campaign? You want me to what? He acted as though I'd asked him to jump through a flaming hoop. I felt certain he was lying when he denied knowing the tune. Double Mint Gum, Ritz Crackers, the theme songs for Alka-Seltzer and Kenmore Appliances. He claimed ignorance on all counts. I knew that it was queer to sing in front of someone, but seeing as he'd been doing it to me for weeks, I started in on an a cappella version of the latest Oscar Mayer commercial, hoping he might join in once the spirit moved him. With total disregard for his company, I sang the same way I did at home when alone in my bedroom, my eyes shut tight and my hands moving in a useless and crippled fashion.
My baloney has a first name. It's O-S-C-A-R. My baloney has a second name. It's M-A-Y-E-R. Oh, I love to eat it every day. And if you ask me why, I'll say that Oscar Mayer has a way with B-O-L-O-G-N-A.
I reached the end of the tune, thinking he might take this as an opportunity to applaud or maybe even apologize for underestimating me. But instead he held up his hand, saying, "Hey, guy, I'm not into that scene. There were plenty of screwballs like you back in Atlanta, and I don't know, I guess it's your thing or whatever, but you can definitely count me out." The remainder of the hour was spent awkwardly watching the clock as we silently pretended to tune our guitars.
After all these years of listening to David Sedaris and reading David Sedaris, don't you feel as if you grew up with that family next door?
Oh, yeah. No, I know what's in their cabinets. Yeah. I know the color of their kitchen.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I know about their other property, the beach house, the house in France.
The ones in the Outer Banks. I think they had one. Yeah. But, you know, Steve Pride tells me that David Sedaris is one of the very nicest guests, one of the most polite and friendly guests we have ever had on the show.
And that's saying a lot. Because we have talked
We've
to some lovely people.
We've had some amazing people on this show. So anyway.
Okay.
For KPFK's Gay Day in 2009, and that is what we called it, Gay Day, we put out a call for personal stories, and we're pleased to hear from 16-year-old Jessica Pensner, who wanted to interview her 13-year-old brother, Ben.
You have got to be taught to hate and fear. Day after day, year after year.
I'm Benjamin, and this is my sister, Jessica Pensner. She's 16 years old.
Hi, I'm Jessica. This is my brother, Ben, and he is 13 years old. Okay, Ben, so when did you come out?
I was 10, fifth grade. It was during a school day, and my teacher, Jude, he was gay, too. He is gay, too. And I thought that I liked a couple guys in my class. I was really, really confused because of all the things that was going on. I was 10. I don't think I knew very much about that kind of stuff. So then the first time I told anybody was my mom. I went back to my mom's house after school, and then I sort of put my face to the back of my mom. On my mom's back. Then I said, "Mom, I think I'm gay." And she was like, "What did you say?" And then I said, "Mom, I think I'm gay." And then she was like, oh, okay. And that's all she said.
And you told me after that, right?
Mm-hmm.
How was that experience for you? Because I couldn't see inside your head at the time.
It was really different for me. I've never experienced something like that before. So we were in Mom's room, and I told you, and I said, Jessica, I think I'm gay. And then you said, I think I'm bi. And then when we hugged, we were crying, and then I felt really, really open. I felt, like, really close to you.
And that was, like, the first time that we felt so close, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Because you were only 10, and that was a bad time for me, too. We were both just going through some really weird times. I'm really glad you told me then.
Me too. So how did you feel about it?
Oh my gosh. Well, when you told me, I wasn't just crying. I was sobbing. I didn't know how to feel, like, to tell you the truth. I have never been against gays or against anything that they stood for because, you know, I was... still am bisexual. But you, my brother, being gay was such a trip for me. I wasn't sad that you were gay. I wasn't disappointed or anything. It was just so overwhelming. And then afterwards, I had some time to feel, to think about it and to figure out my feelings, and I was so happy. I was one of those girls who would always want the gay best friend who we could, you know, hang out with and go talk about girly things. And, oh, my gosh, that person is my brother. It's amazing to have you, Ben. It really is. And the fact that you're there for me and are always so nice. You're just such a nice person. And I can't believe that I have you. And that you knew by 10? I mean, really?
Yeah, it was really weird for me, too.
What did you talk to Jude about, anyway?
Oh, fifth grade teacher. After I told our parents, our dad thought of go talking to Jude because he knew that he was gay because we found out about a paper that they handed out at school.
That said that Jude was gay?
No, that said that Jude was living with his husband.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which basically says that Jude is gay.
Yeah. So then Dad said, maybe we should go talk to him and see what his perception of this was. So after school, Dad and Mom went to the school after all the classes were done. We sat down at one of the tables, and then I told Jude, and then he was like, okay. And then we talked about how he was gay and how he came out, that he couldn't come out until college. And he thought of me as really brave of coming out at 10 years old. And then we talked about his high school years, how he forced himself to keep his girlfriend because his friends were not gay supporters, and how he thought of it, and he said that it felt like torture. So he came out in college, and he regretted it, that he didn't come out sooner, and that he was really happy for me.
And you've got to be taught before it's too late, before you reach 6 or 7 or 8. To hate all the people your relatives hate, you've got to be carefully taught.
And props to the gay teacher, Jude, because I think if I were in that position and a pair of parents and a 10-year-old showed up at my door to have this discussion, I would just think, this is so far beyond my pay scale.
I know. But you also know how significant that is.
Oh, I know,
I mean,
I know.
I would cry if yeah. someone did that. I'd be so honored and touched yeah. and wish that had happened yeah. for me.
In fifth grade, that would never have happened. I mean, just the whole coming out at that age and having a gay teacher and knowing the teacher was gay, on every level, I thought, what?
And then the parent making a yeah, wonderful yeah. choice like yeah, yeah, that. Yeah. Oh. Well, Ben is 21 now and is still playing the viola.
And still to come, the conclusion of Jessica's interview with her brother Ben.
Sam Harris in Billy Bean Share Stories.
And we jump into the gay back machine and revisit Stephen Raines and the first class of his My Life is Poetry workshops.
Tab Hunter's Secret, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Blonde and tanned with surf boy good looks, Tab Hunter was one of the hottest teen idols of the 1950s. He would ultimately star in over 40 films. At the time, Hunter had fictitious romantic relationships with close friends Debbie Reynolds and Natalie Wood, cooked up to dispel the gay rumors. In his 2006 autobiography, he acknowledged he is gay. Hunter had long-term relationships with actor Anthony Perkins and figure skater Ronnie Robertson. He's now settled down with his partner for over 30 years, Alan Glazer. What was also unknown in the 1950s was his love of both singing and Broadway musicals. That would lead to his 1957 number one hit single, Young Love. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Scott Ilnicki.
Welcome back. You're listening to IMRU Radio. I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
We return to the conversation between Ben and Jessica Pensner.
It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught.
Are you happy that you came out so soon?
Yeah. I don't have to lie as much as I thought I did.
Did you know at 10, or did you know earlier than that?
I had a pretty okay perception of it at 10. I was still iffy about it. There was this one person that I did tell in middle school. I forgot who he was, but he said that you can't know until you're 17. So I was like, oh, okay. But later on, I got a better understanding of it, and then I said, wow, that was such a lie. But anyway, at 10, I was not sure at all. I was confused, as most people are at that age, if they think of it.
Well, now we go to Renaissance Arts Academy, right?
Yeah.
And we came there right after that whole fifth grade fiasco.
Oh, yeah.
And our school is very open with that kind of thing. And anyone who is of any sexual orientation does not feel out of place. Did you feel like you had a better understanding of who you were in that school?
Yeah. I had a lot of people to talk to. I felt so much better at Ren Arts than at VCCS, my middle school, because it was really small. So everybody knew each other, and it was really interesting to talk to people about it because they were really open to the subject. And there are some gay people at our school, just not as many.
Is it easier to talk about it with your friends at Ren Arts?
Yes. Yeah, it really is. I actually talk about it as a regular subject now because I've talked to them about it so much. There's this place called the Renaissance Fair, and there's this girl named Taylor, and she's a friend of mine, and she's a lesbian, and me and her talk about it in detail. It's really nice to talk to her about that.
Are you glad that you have someone like that, that you can release what you've been holding in for so long to?
Yes, it really is. I'm so happy that I don't have to bottle it up so much. It makes me feel incredible. It's awesome. I've done it before. I've stopped myself from telling people that I was gay. And I have to lie, and I'm not the best liar. I suck at lying.
Yeah, you do.
Then they ask me again, and I have to lie again.
Well, you don't have to lie anymore.
I know.
You don't have to lie to anyone, even if they are against what you are. It doesn't matter. They can't do anything to you. And if you ever need help, I'm here, and all our friends are here. So don't worry about it, okay?
Okay.
So now you're at Renart's, and you're the viola prodigy. You are the gay, blonde, blue-eyed viola prodigy. How does that feel to be so wonderful?
I like it how everybody knows me, and I don't know them. It's fun. Sometimes I feel kind of famous at that school. It's really, really nice.
That's good. You're gonna play something, right?
Yeah.
You wanna go do that right now?
Yeah.
Go for it.
And here's a little update. Ben has apparently performed in a variety of orchestras, including the Pasadena Pops, so you may have caught him yourself.
In my hometown.
Your very hometown.
So a little factoid about the viola. I am told, I do not play it, but I am told that the viola is actually very hard to play well. You would not think it would be because it's sort of halfway between a violin and a cello, but it's got its own weird things. It's very hard to make it sing.
Does it stand on the floor like the cello?
I think the old-fashioned ones used to. No, you pick it up. It's like a big fat violin.
Yeah, it's that mid-range. I never know.
So anyway, but I love the viola. So fabulous. And now singer Sam Harris shares a moment from his memoir, Ham, Slices of Life.
Involving Michael Jackson and Elizabeth Taylor at Liza Minnelli's wedding.
Okay, the gayest 10 words I think I've ever heard you say together.
Thank you.
How the world can change. It can change like that due to one little word, married.
Naturally, like at any wedding, all the attention should be paid to the bride and groom. So I tried not to stare at Michael Jackson, but I just couldn't not. He was wearing a rigorously tailored black suit, festooned with velvet and sequined piping, and a darling Peter Pan collar centered with a diamond brooch. His hair was flat ironed into a flirty Marlo Thomas flip. His face couldn't have been whiter if he'd been an Irishman locked in a windowless basement his entire life. I'd met Michael on several previous occasions since the mid-80s, and he'd become less and less human each time, not only in appearance, but in manner, his very person. The man was on his own planet, Michael Planet. His eyes, darkly lined in black, remained closed throughout the service, and his head bobbed and wobbled from side to side to the rhythm of a music no one else could hear. Occasionally, he would titter to himself at an internal joke, showing his teeth just a shade less white than his face, and raise his shoulders like a 5-year-old girl who'd just said the word penis for the first time. On the other side of the altar sat Elizabeth Taylor. She was wearing an ensemble that made me think she'd looked in her closet that morning and said, "What shall I wear?" Everything! But she was still Liz Taylor, and somehow it worked on her, down to the veiled, black, tooled, and feathered hat set slightly askew on her head. Or was she tilting to one side? I'd also met Elizabeth on many occasions since the 80s, and I truly adored and admired her as an actor, humanitarian, and one of the great purveyors of nasty, nasty, dirty jokes. but she was clearly exhausted. And when the priest requested we lower our heads in prayer, she did. And she never came back up. She never came back up.
I always love it when we have guests on the show like Sam Harris and Coco Peru's another one, where they tell their stories from their own personal life. And you wonder, do you live in People magazine? Mm-hmm. I mean, these are experiences I can't imagine just casually having.
We need to get out more, Wenzel.
No. Well, this much seems clear. Anyway, next up, former professional baseball player Billy Beane shares a story from his memoir, Going the Other Way, Lessons from a Life in and Out of Major League Baseball.
Don't run like a faggot, boy. I'll never forget the first time I heard the word on an athletic field. Faggot. I remember repeating to myself, faggot. I was in fourth grade, and I was playing quarterback for my junior All-American team, the Wolfpack. That angry command came from my coach, Jimmy Thompson. It wasn't directed at me. Being the quarterback on the team generally left me above reproach. Instead, it was aimed at Bobby Smith, who had just missed a tackle. Every kid on the field that day got the message, despite what I suspect was our collective ignorance. What exactly was a faggot? How did faggots run? Clearly, it wasn't a good thing. It was probably the worst thing imaginable. It equaled weakness and timidity, everything a budding, insecure jock wanted to avoid. We were only kids. How are we supposed to know the truth? A 6'4" military veteran, Coach Thompson was a lovable guy who taught me the right way to play the game and helped instill in me a drill sergeant's fire for competition. As former Marines, he and my stepfather, Ed, bonded very quickly. An African-American, Coach Thompson wasn't the kind of guy associated with prejudice. He was married to a white woman, and they were raising a biracial child. Even in our integrated neighborhood, this family provided a positive model. Coach had hardly invented the put-downs, fag, queer, girl. At the time, in the early 70s, the word faggot wasn't considered bigotry. My Latino teammates used the term maricón, so I figured that the insult was universal. By the time I reached the majors, I'd heard the terms from almost every coach I'd played for and many that I hadn't. As a motivational strategy, it was effective. Coaches invoked the terms again and again. Players responded, almost reflexively raising their intensity level, and I could already see how much more Bobby bore down after Coach singled him out. Even at that age, just a ragtag band of skinny boys, we were required to prove our manhood to coaches, teammates, and our dads who roamed the sidelines, keyed up by vicarious intensity. It wasn't long before the kids were berating one another with similar epithets, especially when we did anything out of the norm. Crying or even whining was sure to bring a rebuke. It was common for a kid to cry if he dropped a pass, but we learned quickly that this was a huge mistake. Getting mad was far more acceptable. Copying the coaches, we would go on the attack. Damn, Bobby, hold on to the stupid ball, we were saying to each other before long. You're such a sissy. Nearly 20 years later, those words still haunted me.
And when you're a little boy, running and throwing the ball are the tells. They're not the only ones, but those are definite things. You're terrified somebody's going to see you do it because there's the boy way, and then there's the sensitive boy way.
You know, the thing that's really so sad about this is, mm-hmm, I don't think much has changed since he came out in 1999. You know,
well,
I think this is still so painful that for, you know, athletics, and this is, you know, how we judge someone's manhood.
I'm just not around little kids' sports teams ever, so.
Okay.
I'd like to believe it's better.
Since 2014, Billy Beane has served as the first ambassador for inclusion for MLB, which I'm told is Major League Baseball.
And I'm glad somebody told us, because I wouldn't have known that.
I know. I'm a bad lesbian.
Stephen Rains is the former poet laureate of West Hollywood and a mentor to hundreds of gay seniors at the LA Gay and Lesbian Center who have taken his yearly My Life is Poetry workshop since it began in 2011. Let's revisit those beginnings.
I was already out of high school when my friend Stephen Rains was born, but he's never made me feel like I've passed my best if used by date, and I'm not alone. Over the years, Stephen has shared his positive energy with hundreds of his elders through his My Life is Poetry workshops.
I'm Stephen Rains. I'm a poet and educator. We're into our fourth year as a group, kind of creating work together. When I started the group, of course, I knew that we were going to create poems, and what I was surprised at is what a strong community was created in the process, and that this is a group of individuals who maybe knew of each other, but through the class and through coming every week for sessions and sharing their lives and sharing their stories and giving feedback, that we've all grown closer. And, you know, birthdays are celebrated and major life events are talked about and discussed in class, and people really feel safe and comfortable sharing their experiences.
Hi, I'm Michael Kearns. I'm an artist and activist and have been for about, 35 or 40 years. I have a 16-year-old daughter. I'm 61 years old. I'm amazed I'm alive. I mean this. I'm so grateful to be alive, and I've had a great life. It's been up and down, needless to say. And I know you didn't ask this question yet, but I can't begin to tell you how the poetry class has enlivened me as an artist and a person. And I'm serious. It's just given me sort of a new outlet, a new way to express myself, a certain catharsis. I'm a person who gets a lot of catharsis in the course of my work. But this was another avenue for me, and I was very intimidated by the idea of poetry. It's sort of, So this has just been such a really exciting aspect, new and energizing part of my life. My poem is called Flower. He gave me an orchid that had been given to him, the glamorous English actor in his 30s at least. I'm 16. He takes the feathery flower and traces every inch of my body before giving it to me. I wonder what the fan who gave it to him would think of the orchid's meaning in my life these 40-odd years later. I remember the feel, silky, scary, fiery, in love.
I'm Cassandra Christensen. I'm a retired registered nurse and founder of an organization called Project Nightlight, where we trained and provided volunteers to be there in the last hours of life so that no one had to die alone, particularly when there was AIDS. This poem is called Woman to Woman, If I Had a Man Part. If I had a man part, a part of me that grows, stands noble in the smell of you and the waltz of you, that part of me would raise itself up from winter, find you in summer shine. I would be called forth to warmth, responding to full blooming garden of you. Be ignited, stand firm, and soft press into the dark place of you. I would gather your roses in my arms, hold your dearest self as in a driving storm, your rhythm tugging hungry on me, clamoring of want. But without pressing into you, I am adrift of you. Two bodies, but you gulp empty-mouthed at the feasting table. But that I be able to come to your interior, where you wait for the filling, as I gather your bones, your waters falling into depth, plumbing the dark mystery within and without, holding your dearest self, I would that I put my whole self into your silken boat and swing the heaving seas, where the toll bell tolls, shift into radiance to be enclosed, safe, to run crazy in the heat, grab the gold, sift the marrow, then simmer, the cooker claiming the bone, soup rich for the tasting, the child in us liberated to fly into the face of the sun, to fall not back to the earth, but we would bleed past the veil, the creation in our newness, the dawn, food on the table where life's blood flows. Where life's blood flows.
My name is Bob Dahlmeier. I've been living in Los Angeles for 30 years. When I came out here, I got immediately involved with Morris Kite and Don Kilhefner and all of the folks who were involved in the movement at the time. We did lots of things in the streets, in your face. I was involved in the March on Sacramento that we did when Duke Majan cut AIDS funding. I lost so many people to the plague that I wrote this poem in their honor. It's called Tears. A tear for the faceless ones who dreamed this virus up and set it down upon my beloved Robin. A tear for the merchant of gods who construed a disease as religious punishment for my beloved Michelle. A tear for the politicians who gave scant lip service and finally filibustered my beloved Dieter. A tear for the caretakers who cuddle and cradle and clean up after my beloved Ivar. A tear for our cloth graveyard. Its outrageous creativity makes one startling statement for my beloved Tony. A tear for me, nay, for you, diminishing daily with occasional reruns of brilliance for my beloved Jim and Dennis. And Gino and David and Hank and Alan and Jimmy and Jim and Bill and Fred and Bob and Vic and Michael and Leonard and Rue and Rick and Ron and Howard and Jose and Joe and Mike and Rick and Mike and Philip and Carl and Jerry and David and Jerry and Ed and Vince and Robert and Bob and Leo and Tom and Bernard and Giancarlo and Fernando and Kyle and Steve and Vincent and Bill and Tony and Jean-Pierre and Randy and Gary and Corey and Sam and Mark and Peter and Keith and JP and Steve and Vito and Judd and Rand and Michael and Richard and Bob and Terry and Gavin and Giovanni and Lee and Tom and Rue and Jack.
Due to the inequities of our history, GLBT narratives of life before the millennium are rare, and our tribe's emphasis on youth and style over substance even further disenfranchises our seniors, devaluing their stories.
I have a lot of concerns about who creates art in this country and what experiences are documented.
Activist, artist, poet, and teacher, Stephen Rains.
That's one of the things that motivated me to start this workshop, is I really wanted people to share their experiences. There's something about poetry, the economy of language. You know, a poem can take up a page. It's not as intense as writing an entire memoir. That this was really something about just capturing one experience and kind of one moment in time, one feeling, and just containing it all within one page and writing about it. It's definitely more manageable, and it's not as daunting of a task as thinking in terms of writing an entire memoir.
And Stephen's poets are not shy about their feelings for him.
My poem is about Stephen. Yes, our teacher. My first poetry class. Stephen leads us and we are poets. He says our life is poetry, invites us in with simplicity, leads us into complexity, brings valentines, birthday cakes, and passion to the learning. He says our life is poetry, sees our beauty and our gifts, brings valentines, birthday cakes, and passion to the learning. Teaching with examples, believing in our writing, sees our beauty and our gifts, brings the learning out of us. Teaching with examples, believing in our writing, Stephen, dedication, sensitivity, courage, brings the teachings out of us, invites us in with simplicity, leads us into complexity. Sees our beauty and our gifts. Stephen leads us, and we are poets.
I take it you like Stephen Rains.
Well, he's a little like a Pied Piper. We all come toddling after him as we discover our magnificence. What he sees in us draws it out of us, inspires us.
Steve Rains is an angel. Steve Rains came along and advertised that he was going to run a class strictly poetry and strictly for seniors. And having
been writing poetry most of my life, I jumped at the chance. And it was just so fortuitous because he's such a good poet and he knows how to get us to be maximum creative. He gets us to really dig deep. And he's also a great guy. He's a lot of fun and he knows poetry. And he is so good with us seniors, bringing out our best. This is a poem for seniors like us. It's called On These Shoulders We Stand. We are all damaged, we gay and lesbian seniors, gathered here with our history of beatings, arrests, entrapments, firings, ostracism. Elder tales for the next generation who cannot comprehend nor appreciate the battles lost and won to advance our march for equality and dignity. Our anthems resonate on our hearts for all to hear, if they will only listen.
When the students are writing poems, not only are we writing poems about the past, but we're also writing poems about the present. You know, what is it like to be gay at the age of 77? That's not an experience that's been documented that often.
My thanks to Stephen Rains for reminding us all, if we spent as much time feeling positive about getting older as we do trying to stay young, it would be a very different world. For IMRU, this is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
So that made me think about the Hear Me Out storytelling competition.
I know, I'm
so
glad the LA Gay and Lesbian Center is having these programs for seniors to tell their stories, to write their poetry, because that's where the stories lie.
Well, poetry, yeah. And because, you know, storytelling, this whole thing, we forget that this art is still what keeps us alive and keeps us inspired. It seems like from another time, but it's not.
I wonder if they have a senior karaoke night.
Well, let's go find out. Not that we're old enough to participate.
No, we're more the drag queen story hour types.
Yeah, that's what we'll be doing next. Well, that is it for tonight, however. Our thanks to IMRU's executive producer, Steve Pride, director Wayne Sampson, board op Ricky Herrera, plus Rainbow Minute producers Jed Proctor and Brian Burns.
Find us online at imruradio.org and follow us on Facebook at IMRU Radio. If you're interested in volunteering with IMRU to help make the magic happen, email volunteer@imruradio.org. Good night.
Sitting here waiting here hoping